This is an ABC podcast.
This is Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia.
Hello and welcome to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Bobby McCumber. From a young age, growing up in Papua New Guinea, Lydia Gar noticed that women were treated differently to men. She noticed it when her mother and her had to do most of the housework, but her brothers didn't. She also noticed it when her brothers went to school and she didn't. Lydia is a survivor of domestic violence. Her book, Survive and Thrive, details her courageous journey out of domestic violence. Since escaping the violent relationship of her first marriage, Lydia has been using education to advocate for everyone's right to be safe in their relationships. I want to let you know that this episode will include descriptions of gender-based violence that you may find distressing. Lydia, welcome.
Thank you.
Lydia, tell me, where did you grow up?
I grew up in a remote village that's in Papua New Guinea. My traditional place that I grew up with was Biala. And growing up, I didn't know anything. The periphery of my life was the end of the village. I didn't know anything else beyond that. So, very insulated, if you can understand that. But, you know, when you're small, you start noticing things, that there are a lot more beyond you. And that's when I pick up on my brother leaving the village in the morning and materializing back in the afternoon. I didn't understand that at that time.
Tell me, when did you learn that your brother was leaving the village each day to go and get educated? What did you think about it?
Curiosity got the better of me. One day, Mom and I went to the garden. And then I said, "Hey, Mama, where does Jackson go from Monday to Friday? And what do they do?" And being my mom, being not educated herself, she just said, "I think he goes to school." And I said, "What is school? I don't even know the meaning of school at that point." And in time, I gathered that, oh, it's where someone goes there and gain learning.
How old were you at that time?
I think I was seven. I was 7 years old.
You eventually did go to school, and it was known as the school that fell from the sky. What's the story behind that name?
Second World War, the Japanese shot down an American pilot who was flying back and forth on New Britain Island. He was shot down, and the people rushed to the bush, and they were looking for him. They wanted to rescue him. And they found him still got caught on the branch of the tree. And they went there and they got him down. And they hid him in the canoe and put banana leaves on the top of the canoe to pretend that they're coming back from the garden, because that was their means of going to the garden. And Japanese, if they saw them, they wouldn't. Concluded, these local people are going back to the village. But unbeknown to them, that the American was underneath the banana and some other bush materials too. He was underneath. They hid him underneath. They got him into the village and they fed him. And for some reason, his partners, you know, the Americans and the Australians that fought at the same time, went out into the forest looking for him. And then when they passed through the village, they asked the village people like that, "Did you see the plane that crashed?" And they said they weren't sure. They didn't want to jeopardize his life. Mm. The minister, meaning the church pastor, went to the American Australians that, "We found him and we are hiding him here. Are you here to kill him or are you here to take him?" They said, "We are here to take him." "Oh, well, he's here." And that was the end. They didn't think of anything else. They said, "As long as we help him and he's still alive, that's the big thing." And lo and behold, some many, many years later, they were surprised that he came back and decided that he would start primary school as a token of appreciation of the village and the area looking after him.
Who and what shaped your views on gender roles growing up?
I grew up in a remote village. Our area was slowly but surely opening to outsiders, and they were bringing a different perspective on the society and how the society should be structured. That was how I was seeing things happening in a different way. I was asking myself, why are things happening? Outsiders coming in, they were going to men. They were going to men to talk about issues that it was women's matters, but they were going to men to talk about those things. For example, they ask men about land. They ask men about areas where they would do the work. And I was too young to add my perspective, my ideas, and confront. I didn't have any capacity to do that at that point in time. But today, as I speak now, nobody goes over our tradition. They have to do the right thing. I have chased a lot from the village because they didn't follow the protocols, traditional protocols.
Lydia, you are a determined woman and you did make it to university. Why did you study social work?
As soon as I found out school means education, every single day I have to walk from my village to the school that I just told you about. It's 9 miles. I don't care. My parents, if they were still alive and you asked them, how was Lydia when she was small and she wanted to go to school? How was her perspective of education? They will tell you, that girl never want to not go to school anytime. She always want to go to school, whether she's sick or not. If flooding, Lydia must go to school. And she makes the father find a way to take her to school. If it's flooding on the road, the father must pedal the canoe and go to school and drop her. And that was the hunger that I had right from day dot. Nothing was to barricade me in. I have to go to school. Whether I'm sick or not, I'm going to school. The only time I'm not going to school is Saturday and Sunday, because it's the time that teachers are not at school and everybody's not at school. And even if I'm sick, I'm going to school.
Determined. I love it, Lydia.
Yeah, my hunger to be educated is, I don't know, I can't control it. I want to be educated. And there was a point, I was still going to primary school. There was a point when an Australian guy, and he was in the middle of doing his master's, and he needed to do some research. And then he went to Papua New Guinea, and he was looking for which village he would stay in a way that he would get more information. He's an anthropologist, yeah. So he wanted to be with all people that would give him some idea of the folklore, the language. They want to know how people live, because anthropologists do. They look at the way people live and interact with each other. Still, I was a primary school girl, and I didn't quite understand what he was there to do. I was curious. Now I'm like, okay, but these are all snippets of my curiosity and my desire to be educated. And so I used to ask him when he come back to Australia. I used to say, hey, Patrick, when you come back, I would like some books. Or sometimes I tell him, but he would come back with magazines. And so simple to read books at the primary school level.
Lydia, you met your first husband at university. Can I ask, when did the violence begin?
It started when I told him that I missed my period. So I told him, I think I may have been pregnant. He assaulted me, and he denied that it was his. And he said, I should go and, you know, find my way how to look after the child. And I hated myself for believing him in the first place when he approached me and he wanted to be friends with me. At that point, we were not married yet. I really hated myself. I had never had a boyfriend before. It would have been good if we just parted with no child, but he waited, and that was the first time I realized his true personality. After abusing me, he said to me that that was not his child. And I'm like, I've never slept with any man. And you're the first one. And after that, it was frequent. It was now and again. And I'm like, what did I do to him?
What event ended the relationship?
That was a pivotal moment that allowed me to take, I'd call it a drastic action. Drastic because I've been thinking about doing it, but afraid. He didn't come home. By then, we had two children. I didn't come home. I picked up the kids and we came home. Cooked our dinner, waited for him. But then I said, as per normal kids, I think your father is not going to be joining us anytime soon. So let's go ahead, prepare dinner. We will eat. I need to go to your bedroom, sleep, and I will sit out here and see if Dad would arrive early tonight. Then they went to bed. And me, I already knew. And because it is kind of a pattern that he does, whenever he doesn't come home quickly, he gets drunk. And when he gets drunk and come home, that's a beating I will get. And so I just knew it's not going to be good for me tonight. And I waited, and I felt I was beginning to fall asleep. So I went into bed, fast asleep. Deep sleep. And it must have been 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning. I felt the hand lifted me up and threw me to the side of the bedroom. And I thought I was dreaming. And when one side of my body landed on the wall, the bedroom wall, I suddenly realized I came back to consciousness, and I cried out, and I realized that, oh, this man is here, and he just threw me, to the side of the bedroom wall. And when he did that, I sustained a broken rib, and he picked me up again. Then he said, where is my food? And I said, we left your food in the stove because you didn't come early. And the food is there. And he said, go and get my food. So I walked to the kitchen area, to the oven. By then, as you would guess, the food is, of course, it's cold. Because he didn't come home until between 1 and 2. What do you expect the food to be, like? So I got the plate of food. I handed it over to him. He knew that food is already completely cold. And he just turned the plate around. It's a chinaware plate around, and he smacked the entire plate of food onto my face, and it was bleeding, my face. And he said, right now, cook me food. So I stayed in the kitchen area to cook him new food. So I put sweet potato in the pot, and he kept on back and forth asking, and is the food ready, or is it boiling? Or and I said, oh, not yet. And whenever I say not yet, he would punch me on the face. And he kept on doing that until I said to him that, oh, it's boiling now. I will have to take the sweet potato off. When he heard that, he came straight into the bedroom, kitchen, and he said, stand away. I will carry the pot. He poured that boiling water on my head, and it got all my face. And when I say face, it's everything in my face, my ears and my nose and my, apart from my eyes, because I looked away, I lost the rest of my hair, was gone, and my head, the scalp of my head, all gone. And when he did that, I fell. I was exhausted, and it was painful. And I, what's the English word again? I fainted. I fainted right there in the kitchen. And my two next door neighbors, one from San Francisco and the other one from New Zealand, they heard me shouted and silent. And they didn't feel right about it. They've been hearing me abused all of these years, but that kind of sound that they heard on the night, it was really different. And they came in, but you know, for some reason, when he ran away, my ex-husband ran away out, he forgot to lock the door. He thought he closed the door, but the door was ajar. And so when the two staff, when they came, called my name, they said, "Lydia, where are you?" It was silent because I was already gone. I fainted. I was gone completely. And when they walked in, they heard my two children hugging each other and crying because they had, by then, I heard a commotion inside the kitchen. And the girl, my daughter, must have mentioned that mommy's in the kitchen. When they came, reached the kitchen, they saw me flat out in the kitchen. They turned me around and they called me. I was completely gone. And they were so scared. They carried me, they put me in their car, they rushed me to the hospital. All that, I didn't know. I was not conscious to tell you how they did it. I don't know. All I knew was that 3 days later, I woke up in the hospital. That's all I know.
Who looked after you in hospital, Lydia?
The hospital staff, the nurses and hospital staff, but one of the lecturer is from Australia. He was a priest. I was, you know, always having a conversation with him and telling the students, you know, some of the issues that they were facing, and being a religious teacher be mindful of the students. I was always talking to him about that. And anyway, he heard that I was taken to the hospital because something drastic bad happened to me, and he rushed to the hospital. When before he reached the hospital, he had talked to a private doctor and said that there is a staff member in the hospital abused by her husband. I'm going to take her out of the hospital. Can I come and leave her with you? Because she has a very big, bad burn around her face. I mean, at the head, to the face, to the neck areas. And fortunately, they are from Egypt, and they are all specialists of skin. Lecturer went to the hospital, talked to the hospital manager, and said, "I would like Lydia to be dismissed from the hospital because I'm taking her to the private clinic, and she's going to stay there and under the care of the private clinic doctors. They are husband and wife." So he took me. I was still very weak. He took me to the private hospital and private clinic and told the couple again. He repeated himself, but this time I was listening to what he was saying. He said, "I would like her here with you, treating her for as long as she needs that treatment. I am going to take care of finances regarding her treatment." I was so moved. I was so moved by how he could, you know, dedicate, you know, it's as if he knew my needs. I don't think I would afford the cost of the private clinic or the hospital. So anyway, he left me there until I was able to walk. I was able to step out of the house without the wind getting to my empty, you know, exposing my top bit was very trying, because when the wind touched, it's excruciatingly painful. And they told me, you can't get out, you can't go anywhere until we bandage your head. So then I stayed there for, I think, must be 5 months with them, until they said, do you want to go? I said, I don't have a house. I left the house. I'm not going to go back. And then the police heard about it, and they came to me and they said, are you well enough to write an affidavit? And I said, not really, but give me another week and I will write it. I was waiting for 1 week. I was already writing my affidavit, because that moment just told me, I'm done. I'm not going to go back to the house, and I'm not, you know, with him and I, we are gone. We are done.
Mm.
Yeah. My connection with him is ended there.
So Lydia, this couple kept you in their home. Where were your children at this time?
They are with him at that time. But when I went to the court was when everything sorted itself out. He lost them, he lost me, and he was in prison. I took him to prison.
How did that feel?
Oh, I'll tell you. That morning when I was walking towards the courthouse, it's almost like I was flying or I was dancing. Or it's a different kind of thinking, a mentality. I'm like, oh, this is the feeling that I really lost. For 12 years, I lost this feeling, that happiness feeling. I was walking towards the courthouse and I said, Lord, today's my day. Please bring it on. I went there. And so in the courthouse, it just so happened that I was the first one. My case was the first one. The lawyer called out for me because I was the owner of the case, that I would put forward the evidence of the case that I was there for that morning. And I stepped forward and I said, you request for evidence. I here present to you, and I turn my head to him, and then I turn around my back. I showed him that my shoulder and my back around the neck, the front neck, the back neck, and my front head, the back head. And I said, Your Worship, this is my evidence. And I showed him my hand. Remember I told you that he came in and he threw me against the wall?
Yeah.
I showed him, because I, by then, wearing a sling, you know, on my hand. And I showed him that too. And I said, yeah, if you need anything else, let me know. And I sat down. Every single, you know, person in that courtroom must all be in tears. I felt it. And when he handed down his final decision and declaring me and him no longer husband and wife, I wasn't, you know, in check with my feelings to hold back my joy. I just blurted all out. I said, Hallelujah. And then I stopped halfway and I'm like, oh no, I've said that. But that, because the happiness was so powerful. And also it demonstrates how I missed feeling happy. For 12 years, I never felt that. When I was an innocent young girl, I was filled with happiness everywhere. And then that 12 years, I was in a cage. That was, I think, the beginning of a regrowth for me.
Hmm. What made you want to tell this story publicly?
Being a survivor of domestic violence and bringing me to where I am, there is a lot of learning lessons that I gain. And for me, not only telling the story, but also writing a book. It's not necessarily for me. Talking to you today, not necessarily for me. I could just keep quiet with my story. And I'm a counselor. I sit down with survivors. I sit down with abuse clients and I had to do something for any woman. I wrote a book for everyone to know the difficulties for those like me who found ourselves in that predicament to try to get out. It is difficult. It is difficult when others ask, why can't you come out? It's not that easy. It took me 12 years. One, I was scared of him. And also, given I have two children, his two children, how do I manage that? And as a single mother, how do I manage our life? I grew up in a Christian family. Marriage is for life. And I said, I don't think God would want you to suffer for the rest of your life. Surely, no. And I didn't want to challenge that mentality or that interpretation. I do now. I challenge. And all those elements that kept me to staying for 12 painful years. And I see, even now, I still apologize for my two children for staying that long. Because even though it's not hurting them, but by the virtue of them seeing the abuse, they are abused in a way. Because they are there. They are scared. They cry. They have tears when he abused me. Mm. Whenever he hurt me, they also hurt. And I still, even to this point, I still saying apologies to them. And, you know, my son always said, Mom, it's all gone. I said, yeah, it's all gone, but I have to keep saying sorry until I die. Because I kept you with me for a long time. I said, yeah, you just have to do what was good for you at the time. You didn't know what you do know now. And I said, thank you for your understanding.
How proud do your children make you?
Oh, very proud, because I see the same or similar type of tenacity that I had, that I have through all these issues that I faced in my life.
Lydia, thank you so much for joining me from Cairns and for sharing so openly your story of survival.
Thank you. Thank you for interviewing me today. Thank you.
That was Lydia Garr, author of Survive and Thrive, My Courageous Journey Out of Domestic Violence. You've been listening to Stories from the Pacific. I'm Bobby McCumber. To catch more great stories about incredible people from the Pacific, just search for ABC Pacific. And if you have or know someone with a story to share, you can email our team at storiesfromthepacific@abc.net.au. This story was produced on the lands of the Yuggera and Turrbal people.
Falava. I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.